The words aren't just something on the surface. The words and melody are so inseparable in my mind, though. I can't look at the lyrics as pure poetry and decide how persuasive they are by themselves. He shakes his head slightly. At any rate, she was definitely blessed with a natural talent and had a real sense for music. She was also practical enough to grab an opportunity when it came along. If that terrible incident hadn't taken her out of circulation, I'm sure she would have developed her talent even further. In any number of ways, it's a real shame. So where did all that talent go? Oshima looks at me. You're asking where Miss Saiki's talent went to after her boyfriend died. I nod. If talent's a kind of natural energy, doesn't it have to find an outlet? I don't know, he replies. Nobody can predict where talent's headed. Sometimes it simply vanishes. Other times it sinks down under the earth like an underground stream and flows off to who knows where. Maybe Miss Saiki focused her talents somewhere else, other than on music, I venture. Somewhere else? Oshima, obviously interested, knits his brow. What do you mean? I'm at a loss for words. I don't know. I just feel maybe that's what's happened. Maybe into something intangible. Intangible? Something other people can't see, something you pursue for yourself, an inner process. Oshima brushes his hair off his forehead, locks of it spilling between his slender fingers. That's an interesting idea. For all we know, after Miss Saiki came back here, maybe she used her talents somewhere out of sight, as you said, for something intangible. But you have to remember she disappeared for about 25 years. So unless you asked her yourself, there's no way of knowing for sure. I hesitate, then decide to just go ahead. Can I ask you something really stupid? Really stupid? I blush. Totally off the wall. No problem. I don't necessarily mind stupid off-the-wall things. I can't believe I'm actually saying this to somebody. Oshima waits for me to go on. Is it possible that Miss Saiki is my mother? Oshima leans back against the counter, taking time to search for the right words. The clock on the wall ticks away as I wait. Finally, he speaks up. So what you're saying is that when she was 20, Miss Saiki left Takamatsu in despair and was living alone somewhere when she happened to meet your father, Koichi Tamura, and they got married. They were blessed with you, and then, 4 years later, something happened and she ran away, leaving you behind. After this, there's a mysterious blank, but then she shows up back in Shikoku. Do I have that right? Yeah. It's not impossible. What I mean is, at this point, I don't have any evidence to refute your hypothesis. So much of her life is a total mystery. Rumor has it she lived in Tokyo. Plus, she's about the same age as your father. When she came back to Takamatsu, though, she was alone. How old did you say your sister is? 21. The same age as me, Oshima says. I'm not your sister. That much I know for certain. I've got parents, and my brother, all related by blood. A family way too good for me. He folds his arms and looks at me for a while. I've got a question for you. Have you ever looked at your birth certificate? That would give your mother's name and age. Of course I have. So what did it say? There wasn't any name, I say. He looks surprised. No name? How can that be? There wasn't any. No kidding. I have no idea why. As far as my birth certificate is concerned, I have no mother, nor an older sister. There's only my father's name and mine on the certificate. Legally, I'm a bastard, an illegitimate child. But you actually had a mother and sister at one time. I nod. I did, until I was 4. The 4 of us lived together. It's not just my imagination. I remember it very clearly. The 2 of them left soon after I turned 4. I pull out my wallet and show Oshima the photo of me and my sister playing at the shore. He gazes at it for a moment, smiles, and hands it back. "Kafka on the shore," he says. I nod and put the photograph back in my wallet. The wind swirls outside, pounding rain against the window. The ceiling light casts shadows of me and Oshima on the floor, where we look like we're having an ominous talk in some alternative world. "You don't remember your mother's face?" Oshima asks. "You lived together till you were four, so you should have some memory of what she looked like." I shake my head. I just can't remember, not at all. I don't know why, but the part of my memory where her face should be is dark, painted over, blank. Oshima ponders this for a while. "Tell me more about why you think Miss Sayaki might be your mother." "That's enough," I say. "Let's just forget it. I'm making too much of it." "I don't mind. Go ahead and say what's on your mind," he says. "Then the two of us can decide if you're making too much of it or not." Oshima's shadow on the floor moves in time with his movements, though it's slightly more exaggerated. "There are an amazing number of coincidences between me and Miss Sayaki," I say. "They're like pieces of a puzzle that fit together. I understood this when I listened to Kafka on the Shore. First is the fact that I was drawn to this library, like fate reeling me in. A straight line from Nakano to Takamatsu. Very strange when you think about it." "Like the plot of a Greek tragedy," Oshima says. "Plus," I add, "I'm in love with her."
"With Miss Sayaki?"
"Yeah, probably."
"Probably?"
Oshima repeats, frowning.
"Do you mean it's probably Miss Sayaki you're in love with, or that you're probably in love with her?"
I turn red. "I can't really explain it," I reply. "It's complicated, and there's a lot of stuff I still don't get."
"But you're probably in love. Probably with Miss Sayaki."
"Right," I say. "Very much."
"Probably, but also very much," I nod. "At the same time, it's possible that she's your mother."
Another of my patented nods.
"For a 15-year-old who doesn't even shave yet, you're sure carrying a lot of baggage around."
Oshima takes a sip of his coffee and carefully places the cup back on its saucer.
"I'm not saying that's wrong, just that everything has a critical point."
I don't say anything. Oshima touches his temples and is lost in thought for a time. He crosses his slim fingers together in front of his chest.
"I'll try to find that sheet music as soon as I can. I can finish off here, so why don't you go back to your room?"
At lunchtime, I take over from Oshima at the front counter. There are fewer visitors than usual, probably due to the steady rain. When he comes back from his break, he hands me a large envelope with a computer printout of the sheet music for Kafka on the Shore.
"Convenient world we live in," he says.
"Thanks," I tell him.
"If you don't mind, why don't you take a cup of coffee upstairs? No cream or sugar. You make really good coffee."
I make a fresh cup and take it on a tray to the first floor. As always, the door to Miss Saiki's room is open, and she's at her desk, writing. When I put the cup of coffee on her desk, she looks up at me and smiles, then puts the cap back on her fountain pen and rests it on top of the paper.
"So, are you getting used to things around here?"
"Bit by bit," I answer.
"Are you free now?"
"Yes, I am," I tell her.
"Why don't you sit down, then?"
Miss Sayaki points to the wooden chair beside her desk.
"Let's talk for a while."
It's starting to thunder again. Still far away, but gradually coming closer. I do as she says, and take a seat.
"How old are you again?"
16. 15. "I just turned 15, I respond.
"You ran away from home, didn't you?"
"Yes, I did."
"Was there some reason that you had to do that?"
I shake my head. What should I say? Miss Saiki picks up the cup and takes a sip while she waits for my answer. I felt that if I stayed there, I'd be damaged beyond repair, I say.
Damaged? Miss Saiki says, narrowing her eyes.
Yes, I say. After a pause, she says, It sounds strange for a boy your age to use a word like damaged, though I must say I'm intrigued. What exactly do you mean by damaged? I search for the right words. First of all, I look for the boy named Crow, but he's nowhere to be found. I'm left to choose them on my own, and that takes time. Miss Saiki, however, waits there patiently. Lightning flashes outside, and after a time, thunder booms in the distance. I mean that I change into something I shouldn't. Miss Saiki looks at me with great interest.
As long as there's such a thing as time, everybody's damaged in the end, changed into something else. It always happens sooner or later.
But even if that happens, you've got to have a place you can retrace your steps to.
A place you can retrace your steps to?
A place that's worth coming back to. Miss Saiki stares straight at me. I blush, then summon my courage and look up at her. She has on a navy blue dress with short sleeves. She must have a whole closet of dresses in different shades of blue. Her only accessories are a thin silver necklace and a smallish wristwatch with a black leather strap. I look for the 15-year-old girl in her and find her straight away. She's hidden, asleep, like a 3D painting in the forest of her heart. If you look carefully, though, you can spot her. My chest starts pounding again, like somebody's hammering a long nail into the walls surrounding it.
For a 15-year-old, you make a lot of sense.
I have no idea how to respond to that, so I don't say anything. When I was 15, Miss Saiki says with a smile, all I wanted was to go off to some other world, a place beyond anybody's reach, a place beyond the flow of time.
But there's no place like that in this world.
Exactly. Which is why I'm living here, in this world where things are forever being damaged, where the heart is fickle, where time flows past without a break. As if hinting at the flow of time, she's silent for a while. You know, though, she goes on, when I was 15, I thought there had to be a place like that in the world. I was sure that somewhere I'd run across the entrance that would take me to that other world.
Were you lonely when you were 15?
In a sense, I guess. I wasn't alone, but I was terribly lonely. Because I knew that I would never be happier than I was then. That much I knew for sure. That's why I wanted to go, just as I was, to some place where there was no time. What I want is to grow up faster. Miss Saiki pulls back to study my expression.
You must be much stronger and more independent than I am. At your age, I was filled with illusions of escaping reality. But you're standing right up to the real world and confronting it head on. That's a big difference.
Strong and independent? I'm neither. I'm just being pushed along by reality, whether I like it or not. But I don't say anything. You know, you remind me of a 15-year-old boy I used to know a long time ago.
Did he look like me? I ask.
You're taller and more muscular than he was. But there is a resemblance. He didn't enjoy talking with other kids his age. They were on a different wavelength. So he spent most of his time holed up in his room, reading or listening to music. He'd get the same frown lines, too, whenever the topic got difficult.
And you love to read as well.
I nod. Miss Saiki glances at her watch. Thank you for the coffee. Taking that as my signal to leave, I stand up and head for the door. Miss Saiki picks up her black fountain pen, slowly twists off the cap, and goes back to her writing. There's another flash of lightning outside, bathing the room for an instant in a weird colour. The clap of thunder hits a moment later. This time it's closer than before. "Kafka," Miss Saiki says. I stop at the doorway and turn round. I just remembered that I wrote a book on lightning once. A book on lightning. I went all over Japan interviewing people who'd survived lightning strikes. It took me a few years. Most of the interviews were pretty interesting. A small publisher put it out, but it hardly sold. The book didn't come to any conclusion, and nobody wants to read a book that doesn't have one. For me, though, having no conclusion seemed just fine. A tiny hammer in my head is pounding on a drawer somewhere, persistently. I'm trying to remember something. Something very important. But I don't know what it is. By now, Miss Saiki's gone back to her writing, and I go back to my room. The rainstorm continues to batter us for an hour more. The thunder is so incredibly loud that I'm afraid the windows in the library will shatter. Every time a bolt of lightning streaks across the sky, the stained glass window on the landing flashes an image like some ancient ghost on the white wall across from it. By 2 o'clock, though, the storm lets up, and yellowish light begins to spill out between the clouds, as if a reconciliation has finally been forged. Water goes on tumbling down in the gentle sunlight. When evening rolls around, I start closing up the place for the night. Miss Saiki says goodbye to me and Oshima, and heads home. I hear the engine of her Golf, and picture her seated at the wheel, turning the key. I tell Oshima I'll finish locking up. Whistling some aria, he goes off to freshen up in the toilet, then leaves. I listen as the Mazda Miata roars off, the sound fading into the distance. Now the library's all mine. It's much quieter than ever before. I go to my room and study the sheet music for Kafka on the Shore. As I suspected, most of the chords are simple. The refrain, though, has a couple of tricky ones. I go to the reading room and try playing it on the upright piano. The fingering's really tough, so I practice it over and over, trying to get my hands around it, and somehow wind up getting it to sound right. At first, the chords sound all wrong. I'm sure it's a misprint, or that the piano's out of tune. But the longer I listen to how those two chords sound one after the other, the more I'm convinced the whole song hangs on them. These two chords are what keeps Kafka on the Shore from degrading into some silly pop song. Give it a special depth and substance. But how in the world did Miss Saiki come up with them? I go back to my room, boil water in the electric kettle, and make tea. I take out the old records we found in the storeroom and put them on the turntable one after another. Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde, the Beatles' White Album, Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, Stan Getz's Getz Gilberto, all hit albums from the 60s. That young boy, with Miss Saiki right beside him, must have done what I'm doing, putting the records on the turntable, lowering the needle, listening to the music coming out of these speakers. The music feels like it's taking me and the whole room off to some different time, a world before I was even born. As I enjoy the music, I review the conversation we had that afternoon, trying to capture our exact words. When I was 15, I thought there had to be a place like that in the world. I was sure that somewhere I'd run across the entrance that would take me to that other world. I can hear her voice right beside me. Inside my head, something knocks at a door, a heavy, persistent knock. An entrance. I lift the needle off the Stan Getz album, pull out the single of Kafka on the Shore, place it on the turntable, and lower the needle, and listen to her sing. The drowning girl's fingers search for the entrance stone and more. Lifting the hem of her azure dress, she gazes at Kafka on the Shore. The girl who comes to this room most likely located that entrance stone. She's in another world, just as she was when she was 15. And at night, she comes to visit this room. In her light blue dress, she comes to gaze at Kafka on the shore. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I remember my father talking about how he'd once been struck by lightning. He didn't tell me this himself. I'd read about it in an interview in a magazine. When he was a student at art school, he had a part-time job as a caddy on a golf course. One day he was following his golfer around the course when the sky suddenly changed color and a huge thunderstorm crashed down on them. They took refuge under a tree just as it was hit by a bolt of lightning. This huge tree was split right in two. The golfer he was caddying for was killed, but my father, sensing something, leapt away from the tree in time. He had some light burns, his hair was singed, and the shock of the lightning threw him against a rock. He struck his head and lost consciousness, but survived the ordeal with only a small scar on his forehead. That's what I was trying to remember this afternoon, standing there in Miss Saiki's doorway listening to the roar of the thunder. It was after he recovered from his injuries that my father got serious about his career as a sculptor. As Miss Saiki went around interviewing people for her book, maybe she met my father. It's entirely possible. There can't be that many people who've been struck by lightning and lived, can there? I breathe very quietly, waiting for the dawn. A cloud parts and moonlight shines down on the trees in the garden. There are just too many coincidences. Everything seems to be speeding up, rushing towards one destination.
26. It was already pretty late in the afternoon, and they had to find a place to stay for the night. Oshino went to the tourist information booth at Takamatsu Station and had them make a reservation at an inn. It was within walking distance of the station, which was nice, but otherwise was typical and somewhat stolid. Neither Oshino nor Nakata minded much, though. As long as there were futons to sleep on, they were fine. As before, breakfast was provided, but they were on their own for dinner. This particularly suited Nakata, who was liable to drop off to sleep at any time. Once they were in their room, Nakata had Hoshino lie face down on the futon, got on top of him again, and pressed down with both thumbs up and down his lower back, carefully checking the condition of his joints and muscles. This time he was much more gentle, just tracing the spine and checking out how tense the muscles were. "Something wrong?" Hoshino asked anxiously.
"No, everything's fine. Nakata doesn't find anything wrong with you now. Your spine's in good shape."
"That's a relief," Hoshino said. "I wasn't looking forward to another torture session."
"I know. Nakata's really sorry. But you did tell me you didn't mind pain, so I went ahead and did it as hard as I could."
"Yeah, I know that's what I said. But listen, Gramps, there are limits. Sometimes you've got to use common sense. But I shouldn't be complaining. You did fix my back. But man alive, I never felt anything like that in my life. The pain was unimaginable. It felt as though you were ripping me apart. Like I died and came back to life or something."
"Nakata was dead for 3 weeks once."
"No kidding," Hoshino said.
Still face down, he took a gulp of tea and munched on some snacks he'd bought.
"So you really were dead?"
"I was."
"Where were you all that time?"
"Nakata doesn't remember. It felt as if I was somewhere far away, doing something else. But my head was floating and I can't remember anything. Then I came back to this world and found out I was stupid. I couldn't read or write any more."
"You must have left your ability to read and write over on the other side."
"Maybe so."
The two of them were silent for a time. Hoshino decided it was best to believe whatever the old man told him, no matter how eccentric it sounded. At the same time he felt uneasy, as if pursuing this dead-for-3-weeks notion any further would lead him into some chaotic, out-of-control situation. Better to turn the conversation back to more practical matters.
"So, now that we're in Takamatsu, Mr. Nakata, where are you planning to go?"
I have no idea, Nakata replied. I don't know what I am supposed to do.
What about that entrance stone?
That's right. Nakata clean forgot about it. We have to find the stone. But I don't have a clue where to look. My mind's floating and won't clear up. I wasn't too bright to begin with, and this kind of thing only makes it worse.
We're in a bit of a fix then, aren't we?
Yes, I'd say we are.
Not that sitting here staring at each other's all that much fun. This won't get us anywhere.
You're right.
I think we should go around asking people, you know, if that stone's somewhere near here.
If you say so, then that's what Nakata wants to do. I'm pretty dumb, so I'm used to asking people questions.
My grandpa always said that asking questions is embarrassing for a moment, but not asking's embarrassing for a lifetime.
I agree. When you die, everything you know disappears.
Well, that's not what he meant exactly, Hoshino said, scratching his head. Anyway, do you have any kind of mental image of the stone? What kind of stone it is? How big it is? Its shape or colour? What's it used for? If we don't have some details, it's hard to ask. Nobody's going to know what the heck we're talking about if we just say, is there an entrance stone anywhere around here? They'll think we're nuts. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I might be dumb, but I'm not nuts.
Okay.
The stone Nakata's looking for is very special. It's not so big. It's white and doesn't have any smell. I don't know what it's used for. It's round, sort of like a rice cake.
He held up his hands to indicate something the size of an LP record.
So if you spotted it, think you'd recognize it? You know, like, hey, here it is.
Nakata would know it right away.
There must be some kind of story or legend behind it. Maybe it's famous and on display at a shrine or someplace.
It could be, I suppose.
Or maybe it's just in some house, and people use it as a weight when they make pickles.
No, that's not possible.
Why not?
Because nobody can move the stone.
Nobody except you, you mean?
Yes, I think Nakata probably can.
After you move it, then what?
Nakata did an uncharacteristic thing. He thought this over for a good long time. At least he looked like he was, briskly rubbing his short salt-and-pepper hair.
I don't really know about that, he finally said. All I know is it's about time somebody moved it.
Hoshino did some pondering himself.
And that somebody's you, right? At least for now.
Yes, Nakata replied. That's correct.
Is the stone to be found only in Takamatsu?
No, it isn't. It doesn't really matter where it is. It just happens to be here right now. It would be much easier if it was in Nakano Ward.
But moving that kind of stone must be risky.
That's right. Maybe Nakata shouldn't bring this up, but it is very dangerous.
Damn,
Hoshino said, slowly shaking his head. He put on his Chunichi dragon's cap and pulled his ponytail out through the hole in the back.
This is starting to feel like an Indiana Jones film or something.
The next morning they went to the tourist information booth at the station to ask if there were any famous stones in Takamatsu or the vicinity.
Stones?
The girl at the counter said, frowning slightly. She'd been trained to introduce all the usual tourist places, but nothing beyond that, and the question clearly had her flustered.
What sort of stones are you looking for?
A round stone about so big, Hoshino said, forming his hands in a circle about the size of an LP, just as Nakata had done.
It's called the Entrance Stone.
Entrance Stone?
Yep, that's the name. It's pretty famous, I imagine.
Entrance to what, though?
If I knew that, I wouldn't have to put you to all this trouble.
The girl thought about it. Hoshino gazed at her face the whole time. Kind of pretty, he judged, though her eyes were a bit too far apart, giving her the look of a wary ox. She made a few calls, but it didn't look like she was getting anywhere.
I'm sorry, she said eventually. Nobody's heard of a stone by that name.
Nobody?
She shook her head. Excuse my asking, but are you here just to find this stone?
Yeah, I don't know if it's just to see it. Anyway, I'm from Nagoya, the old guys from Nakano Ward in Tokyo.
Yes, Nakata's from Nakano Ward, Nakata chimed in. I rode in a lot of lorries and even got treated to eel once. I've come this far and haven't spent a cent of my own money.
I see, the girl said. Not to worry. If nobody knows about the stone, what are you going to do, eh? It's not your fault. But maybe they call it something else. Are there any other famous stones around here? You know, something with a legend behind it, maybe, or some stone people pray to, anything like that?
The girl looked timidly at Hoshino with her two far-apart eyes, taking in his Chunichi dragon's cap, his hair and ponytail, his green-tinted sunglasses, pierced ear and rayon allure shirt.
I'd be happy to tell you how to get to the city public library. You could research the stone there. I don't know much about stones myself, I'm afraid.
The library, however, yielded nothing. There wasn't a single book in the place devoted to stones in or around Takamatsu. The reference librarian, saying they might run across a reference somewhere, plonked down a stack of books in front of them. Legends of Kagawa Prefecture, Legends of Kobo Daishi in Shikoku, A History of Takamatsu, and more of the same. Sighing deeply, Hoshino started leafing through them. For his part, Nakata carefully turned one page after another in a photo collection entitled Famous Stones of Japan.
I can't read, he said, so this is the first library I've ever been in.
I'm not proud of it, Hoshino said, but this is a first for me too, even though I can.
It's pretty interesting now that we're here.
Glad to hear it.
There's a library in Nakano Ward. I think I'll stop by there every now and then. The best thing is they don't charge anything. Nakata had no idea they'd let you in if you can't read.
I've got a cousin who was born blind, but he goes to the cinema, Hoshino said. What fun can that be?
I can see, but I've never been to a cinema.
You kidding? I'll have to take you sometime.
The librarian came over and warned them to keep their voices down, so they stopped talking and went back to their books. When he'd finished with Famous Stones of Japan, Nakata put it back on the shelf and began leafing through Cats of the World. Muttering all the while, Hoshino managed to look through all the books piled up next to him. Unfortunately, he couldn't find any matches in any of them. There were several references to the stone walls of Takamatsu Castle, but the stones in those walls were so massive that for Nakata to pick one up was out of the question. There was also a promising legend about Kobo Daishi, a famous scholarly monk of the Heian period. It was claimed that when he lifted up a stone in the wilderness, a spring gushed out and the place became a fertile rice field, but that was the end of the story. Hoshino also read about one shrine that had a stone called the Treasure of Children Stone, but it was more than a yard tall and shaped like a phallus. No way that could be the one Nakata was looking for. The two of them gave up, left the library and went to a nearby cafe for dinner. They both had noodles topped with tempura, Hoshino ordering an extra bowl of noodles and broth.
I enjoyed the library, Nakata said. I had no idea there were so many kinds of cats in the world.
The stone thing didn't pan out, but that's all right, Hoshino told him. We just got started. Let's get a good night's sleep and see what tomorrow brings.
The next morning, they went back to the library. As on the day before, Hoshino read through a huge stack of books, one after the other. He'd never read so many books in his life. By now, he was fairly conversant with the history of Shikoku, and he'd learned that people had worshipped different kinds of stone over centuries. What he really wanted, though, a description of this entrance stone, was nowhere to be found. By the afternoon, his head was starting to ache, so they left the library, lay down on the grass in a park for a long while, and gazed at the clouds drifting by. Hoshino smoked, Nakata sipped at hot tea from his thermos.
"It's going to thunder again tomorrow," Nakata said.
Meaning you're going to make it thunder?
No, Nakata can't do that. The thunder comes by itself.
Thank God for that, Hoshino said. They went back to their inn, took a bath, and then Nakata went to bed and was soon fast asleep. Hoshino watched a baseball game on TV with the sound down low, but since the Giants were giving Hiroshima a severe beating, he got disgusted with the whole thing and turned it off. He wasn't sleepy yet and felt thirsty, so he went out and found a beer hall, ordered a draft and a plate of onion rings. He was thinking of striking up a conversation with a young girl sitting nearby, but then thought it wasn't the time or place to make a pass. Tomorrow morning, after all, it was back to searching for the elusive stone. He finished his beer, pulled on his Junichi dragon's cap, left, and just wandered around. Not the most appealing-looking city, he concluded, but it felt pretty good to be walking around wherever he wanted to, in a place he'd never been before. He always enjoyed walking anyway. A Marlboro between his lips, hands thrust into his pockets, he strolled from one main street to another and down various alleys. When he wasn't smoking, he whistled. Some parts were lively and crowded, others deserted and deathly quiet. No matter where he found himself, though, he kept up the same pace. He was young, healthy, carefree, with nothing to fear. He was walking down a narrow alleyway full of karaoke bars and clubs that looked as if they'd be operating under different names in 6 months, and had just come to a dark, deserted spot when somebody called out behind him, "Hoshino! Hoshino!" in a loud voice. At first he couldn't believe it. Nobody knew him in Takamatsu. It had to be some other Hoshino. It wasn't that common a name, but not that uncommon either. He didn't turn round and kept walking. Whoever it was, though, followed him, calling out his name. Hoshino stopped and turned round. Standing there was a short, old man in a white suit. White hair, a serious pair of glasses, a white moustache and goatee, white shirt and string tie. His face looked Japanese, but the whole outfit made him look more like some country gentleman from the American South. He wasn't much over 5 feet tall, but looked less like a short person than a miniature, scaled-down version of a man. He held both hands out in front of him as if he was carrying a tray. "Mr. Hoshino," the old man said, his voice clear and piercing, with a bit of an accent. Hoshino stared at the man in blank amazement. "Right you are. I'm Colonel Sanders."
"You look just like him," Hoshino said, impressed.
"I don't just look like Colonel Sanders, it's who I am."
"The fried chicken guy?"
The old man nodded heavily. "One and the same."
"Okay, but how do you know my name?"
"Junichi Dragons fans I always call Hoshino. Nagashima's your basic Giants name. Likewise, for the Dragons it's got to be Hoshino, right?"
"Yeah, but Hoshino happens to be my real name."
"Pure coincidence," the old man boomed out. "Don't blame me."
"So what do you want?"
"Have I got a girl for you?"
"Oh, I get it," Hoshino said. "You're a pimp. That's why you're dolled up like that."
"Mr. Hoshino, I don't know how many times I have to say this, but I'm not dressed up as anybody. I am Colonel Sanders. Don't get mixed up here, all right?"
"Okay. But if you're the real Colonel Sanders, what the heck are you doing working as a pimp in a back alley in Takamatsu? You're famous and must be raking in the dough from license fees alone. You should be lounging by the pool somewhere in the States enjoying your retirement. So what's the story?"
"There's a kind of a warp at work in the world."
"A warp?"
"You probably don't know this, but that's how we have three dimensions, because of the warp. If you want everything to be nice and straight all the time, then go and live in a world made with a triangular ruler."
"You're pretty weird, you know that," Hoshino said. "But hanging out with weird old guys seems to be my fate these days. Any more of this and I won't know up from down."
"That may be, Mr. Hoshino, but how about it? How about a nice girl?"
"You mean like one of those massage parlor places?"
"Massage parlor? What's that?"
"You know, those places where they won't let you do the dirty deed but can manage a BJ or hand job. Let you come that way but no in and out."
"No, no,"
Colonel Sanders said, shaking his head in irritation.
"That's not it at all. My girls do it all, hand job, BJ, whatever you want, including the old in and out.
Uh-huh. So you're talking of soap land.
What land?
Stop mucking about, okay? I've got somebody with me and we've got an early start in the morning, so I don't have time for any fooling around tonight.
So you don't want a girl?
No girl, no fried chicken, I'm going back to get some sleep.
But maybe you won't get to sleep that easily,
Colonel Sanders said knowingly.
When a person's looking for something and can't find it, they usually can't sleep very well.
Hoshino stood there, mouth agape, staring at him.
Looking for something? How do you know I'm looking for something?
It's written all over you. By nature, you're an honest person. Everything you're thinking is written all over your face. It's like one side of a split-open dried mackerel. Everything inside your head's laid out for all to see.
Instinctively, Hoshino reached up and rubbed his cheek. He spread his hand open and stared at it, but there was nothing there.
Written all over my face?
So, Colonel Sanders said, one finger held up for emphasis, is what you're looking for by any chance round and hard?
Hoshino frowned and said,
come on, old man, who are you? How could you know that?
I told you, it's written all over your face. You don't get it, do you?
Colonel Sanders said, shaking his finger.
I haven't been in this business all these years for my health, you know. So you really don't want a girl?
I'm looking for a kind of stone. It's called an entrance stone.
I know all about it.
You do?
I don't lie, or tell jokes. I'm a straight-ahead, no-nonsense type of guy.
Do you know where the stone is?
I know exactly where it is.
So could you tell me where?
Colonel Sanders touched his black-framed glasses and cleared his throat.
Are you sure you don't want a girl?
If you'll tell me where the stone is, I'll think about it, Hoshino said dubiously.
Great! Come with me!
Without waiting for an answer, he walked briskly away down the alley. Hoshino scrambled to keep up.
Hey, old man, Colonel, I've only got about 25,000 yen on me.
Colonel Sanders clicked his tongue as he trotted down the road.
That's plenty. That'll get you a fresh-faced 19-year-old beauty. She'll give you the full menu, BJ, hand job, in and out, you name it. And afterwards, I'll throw this in for free. I'll tell you all about the stone.
Jeez, Louise,
Hoshino gasped.
27. It's 2:47 when I notice that the girl's here, a little earlier than last night. This time I stay up, waiting for her to appear. Other than the occasional blink, I don't close my eyes once. I thought I was paying attention, but somehow I miss the actual moment she appears. She has on her usual light blue dress, and is sitting there the same as before, head in hands, silently gazing at the painting of Kafka on the shore. And I'm gazing at her with bated breath. Painting, girl, and me. We form a still triangle in the room. She never tires of looking at the picture, and likewise, I never tire of gazing at her. The triangle is fixed, unwavering. And then something totally unexpected happens. Miss Saeki, I hear myself say. I hadn't planned on speaking her name, but the thought wells up in me and spills out, in a very small voice. But she hears it, and one side of the triangle collapses. Perhaps I was secretly hoping it would. I don't know. She looks in my direction, though not like she's straining to see. Her head still in her hands as she quietly turns her face, as if something, she's not sure what, has made the air tremble ever so slightly. I don't know if she can see me, but I want her to. I pray she notices me and knows I exist. Miss Saeki, I repeat. I can't keep myself from saying her name. Maybe she'll be frightened by my voice and leave the room, never to return. I'd feel terrible if that happens. No, not terrible. That's not what I mean. Devastated is more like it. If she never came back, everything would be lost to me forever. All meaning, all direction, everything. I know this, but go ahead and risk it anyway, and call her name. Of their own accord, almost automatically, my tongue and lips form her name over and over. She's not looking at the painting anymore. She's looking at me. Or at least I'm in her field of vision. From where I sit, I can't see her expression. Clouds move outside and the moonlight flickers. It must be windy, but I can't hear it. Miss Saiki, I say again, carried away by some urgent, compelling, overwhelming force. She lifts her head out of her hands, holds up her right hand in front of her as if to tell me not to say anything more. But is that what she really wants to say? If only I could go up to her and gaze into her eyes to see what she's thinking right now, what emotions are running through her. What is she trying to tell me? What is she hinting at? Damn, I wish I knew. But this heavy just before 3 a.m. darkness has snatched away all meaning. It's hard to breathe, and I close my eyes. There's a hard lump of air in my chest, as if I've swallowed a rain cloud whole. When I open my eyes a few seconds later, she's vanished. All that's left is an empty chair. A shadow of a cloud slides across the wall above the desk. I get out of bed, go to the window, and look out at the night sky, and think about time that can never be regained. I think of rivers, of tides, forests and water gushing out, rain and lightning, rocks and shadows. All of these are in me. The next day, in the afternoon, a detective comes to the library. I'm lying low in my room, and don't know he's there. The detective questions Oshima for about 20 minutes and then leaves. Oshima comes to my room later to fill me in. A detective from a local station was asking about you, Oshima says, then takes a bottle of Perrier from the fridge, uncaps it, pours the water into a glass and takes a drink. How did he know I was here? You used a mobile phone. Your dad's phone. I checked my memory and nod. That night, I ended up all bloody in the woods behind that shrine. I called Sakura on the mobile phone. I did, but only once. The police checked the calling record and traced you to Takamatsu. Normally, police officers don't go into details. But while we were chatting, I persuaded him to explain how they traced the call. When I want to, I can turn on the charm. He also let slip that they couldn't trace the person you called, so it must have been a prepaid phone. Anyhow, they know you were in Takamatsu, and the local police have been checking all the hotels. They found out that a boy named Kafka Tamura, matching your description, stayed in a business hotel in town, through a special arrangement with the YMCA, until May the 28th, the same day somebody murdered your father. At least the police didn't find out about Sakura. I'm thankful for that, having bothered her enough already. The hotel manager remembered that you'd asked about our library. Remember how his assistant called to see if you were really coming here? I nod. That's why the police came here. Oshima takes a sip of Perrier. Naturally, I lied. I told the detective I hadn't seen you since the 28th, that you'd been coming every day, but not one since. You might get into trouble, I say. If I hadn't lied, you'd be in a whole lot more trouble. But I don't want to get you involved. Oshima narrows his eyes and smiles. You don't get it, do you? You already have got me involved. Yeah, I guess so. Let's not argue, okay? What's done is done. Talking about it now won't get us anywhere. I nod, not saying a word. Anyway, the detective left his card and told me to call him right away if you ever showed up again. Am I a suspect? Oshima slowly shakes his head. I doubt it. But they do think you might be able to help them out. I've been following all this in the newspaper. The investigation isn't getting anywhere, and the police are becoming impatient. No fingerprints, no clues, no witnesses. You're the only lead they have. Which explains why they're trying so hard to track you down. Your dad's famous too, so the murder's been covered in detail on TV and in the press. The police aren't about to sit around and twiddle their thumbs. But if they find out you lied to them, they won't accept you as a witness anymore. And there goes my alibi. They might think I did it. Oshima shook his head again. Japanese police aren't that stupid, Kafka. Lacking in imagination, yes, but they're not incompetent. I'm sure they've already checked all the passenger lists for planes from Tokyo to Shikoku. I don't know if you're aware of this, but they have video cameras set up at all the gates at airports to photograph every boarding passenger. By now, they know you didn't fly back to Tokyo around the time of the incident. Information in Japan is micromanaged, believe me. So the police don't consider you a suspect. If they did, they wouldn't send some local officer, but detectives from the National Police Agency. If that happened, they would have grilled me pretty hard, and there's no way I could have outsmarted them. They just want to hear from you whatever information you can provide about the incident. It makes perfect sense, what he says. Anyhow, you'd better keep a low profile for a while, he says. The police might be staking out the area, keeping an eye out for you. He had a photo of you with him, copy of your official junior high class picture. Can't say it looked much like you, though. You looked really mad in the photo. That was the only photograph I left behind. I always tried to avoid having my picture taken, but not having this one taken wasn't an option. The police said you were a troublemaker at school. There were some violent incidents involving you and your classmates, and you were suspended 3 times. Twice, not 3 times, and I wasn't suspended, but I was officially punished, I explain. I breathe in deeply, then slowly breathe out. I have times like that, yeah. You can't control yourself, Oshima says. I nod. And you hurt other people. I don't mean to, but it's as if there's somebody else living inside me. And when I come to, I find out I've hurt somebody. Hurt them how much? Oshima asks. I sigh. Nothing major. No broken bones or teeth knocked out or anything. Oshima sits down on the bed, crosses his legs and brushes his hair off his forehead. He's wearing navy blue chinos, a black polo shirt, and white Adidas trainers. Seems to me you have a lot of issues you've got to deal with. A lot of issues. I look up. Don't you have any? Oshima holds his hands in the air. Not all that many, but there is one thing. For me, inside this physical body, this defective container, the most important job is surviving from one day to the next. It could be simple, or very hard. It all depends on how you look at it. Either way, even if things go well, that's not some great achievement. Nobody's going to give me a standing ovation or anything. I bite my lip for a while, then ask, "Don't you ever think about getting out of that container?" "You mean leaving my physical body?" I nod. "Symbolically, or for real?" "Either one." Oshima flips his hair back with a hand. I can picture the gears going full speed just below the surface of his pale forehead. "Are you thinking you'd like to do that?" I take a breath. "Oshima, to tell you the unvarnished truth, I don't like the container I'm stuck in. Never have. I hate it, in fact. My face, my hands, my blood, my genes. I hate everything I inherited from my parents. I'd like nothing better than to escape it all. Like running away from home." He gazes into my face and smiles. "You have a nice, muscular body. No matter who you inherited it from, you're quite handsome. Well, maybe a little too unique to be called handsome exactly, but you're not bad looking. At least I like the way you look. You're smart, you're quick. You've got a nice cock too. I envy you that. You're going to have tons of girls fall for you, guaranteed. so I can't see what you're dissatisfied with about your container. I blush. Okay, I guess that's all beside the point, Oshima continues. I'm not crazy about the container I'm in, that's for sure. How could I be? This crummy piece of work? It's pretty inconvenient, I can tell you. Still, inside here, this is what I think. If we reverse the outer shell and the essence, in other words, consider the outer shell the essence and the essence only the shell, our lives might be a whole lot easier to understand. I stare at my hands, thinking about all that blood on them, how sticky they felt. I think about my own essence, my own shell, the essence of me, surrounded by the shell that's me. But these thoughts are driven away by one indelible image. All that blood. How about Miss Saiki, I ask. What do you mean? You think she has issues to overcome? You'd better ask her yourself, Oshima says. At 2, I take a cup of coffee on a tray up to Miss Saiki's room, where she's sitting at her desk. As always, there's writing paper and a fountain pen on the desk, but the pen is still capped. Both hands resting on the desk, she's staring off into space. Not that she's looking at anything, just gazing at a place that isn't there. She seems tired. The window behind her is open, the early summer breeze rustling the white lace curtain. The scene is like some beautiful allegorical painting. Thank you, she says, when I put the coffee cup on her desk. You look a little tired. She nods. I imagine I look a lot older when I get tired. Not at all. You look wonderful, as always. She smiles. For someone so young, you certainly know how to flatter a woman. My face reddens. Miss Saiki points to a chair. The same chair as yesterday, in exactly the same position. I take a seat. I'm used to being tired, but I don't suppose you are. I guess not. When I was 15, I wasn't either, of course. She picks up the coffee cup and takes a sip. Kafka, what can you see outside? I look out of the window behind her. I see trees, the sky and some clouds, some birds on tree branches. Nothing out of the ordinary, right? That's right. But if you knew you might not be able to see it again tomorrow, everything would suddenly become special and precious, wouldn't it? I suppose so. Have you ever thought about that? I have. A surprised look comes over her face. When? When I'm in love, I tell her. She smiles faintly, and it continues to hover around her lips. This puts me in mind of how refreshing water looks after someone sprinkled it in a tiny hollow outside on a summer day. Are you in love? She asks. Yes. And her face and her whole being are special and precious to you each time you see her. That's right. And I might lose those. Miss Saiki looks at me for a while, and the smile fades away. Picture a bird perched on a thin branch, she says. The branch sways in the wind, and each time this happens, the bird's field of vision shifts. You know what I mean? I nod. When that happens, how do you think the bird adjusts? I shake my head. I don't know. It bobs its head up and down, making up for the sway of the branch. Take a good look at birds the next time it's windy. I spend a lot of time looking out of that window. Don't you think that kind of life would be exhausting? Always shifting your head every time the branch you're on sways. I do. Birds are used to it. It comes naturally to them. They don't have to think about it, they just do it. So it's not as tiring as we imagine. But I'm a human being, not a bird. So sometimes it does get tiring. You're on a branch somewhere. In a manner of speaking, she says, and sometimes the wind blows pretty hard. She puts the cup back on the saucer, and takes the cap off her fountain pen. This is my signal, so I stand up.